Support for 51% comes from the Master of Arts in Teaching program at Bard College, offering master's degrees and teacher certification in 1 year, graduate study and extensive public school residencies combined with small class sizes, and a focus on the learner as an individual. Now accepting applications, Teaching What Matters, bard.edu/mat/ny.
On this week's 51%, we'll hear about what millennial women think about feminism.
They were concerned with issues of sexual assault. They were concerned with the wage gap. They were concerned with reproductive rights.
Then we tune into a tribute to Maya Angelou, and we bring you a story about fertility treatments and the VA. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
Yes, and I'm saying you ain't pretty.
The word feminist has become a bit of a lightning rod, with some women claiming they believe in equality for the sexes but do not claim the word feminist for themselves. And on college campuses, feminist activism takes different forms depending on where you go to school. So what do millennial women really think about feminism, and how do they take action to achieve it? Dr. Allison Dahl Crossley is the Associate Director of the Clayman Institute for Gender Research at Stanford University and traveled to 3 college campuses across the country to understand the state of feminism for young women today. And now Lauren Schiller of Inflection Point from KALW shares her conversation with Dr. Crossley.
Welcome to the program, Allison.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
What's going on college campuses these days with feminism?
There's a lot going on college campuses these days with feminism. There are so many questions about, are young people interested in activism? Are they not? Do young women understand the inequalities that are around them? Do they not? And I think that when we look closely, we can see there's a lot of campus feminism happening. And it's really striking and important work that they're doing.
What motivated you to set out and go to 3 different types of campuses and really dig in to understand what is happening on campus?
Well, I was really frustrated in some ways because when you read about the feminist movement, there are so many contradictory messages about the state of it. If it's alive, if it's dead, and I don't expect there to be a unifying framework of everybody agreeing on the state of the movement. But there was so much speculation, and there is still so much speculation, but very little empirical data to really dig into those questions about what the state of the movement is among young people in particular. So I wanted to set out and ask some of those questions and think through what is the state of the movement for many young people today.
What were the different themes that you heard?
Well, in many ways, the young feminists who I spoke with continued the traditions of feminists of the past. So they were concerned with issues of sexual assault. They were concerned with the wage gap. They were concerned with reproductive rights. And we know that, unfortunately, those are many of the social ills that feminists have been working on for so long. They were also interested in the intersections of different inequalities, so the connections between racial and gender inequality, in the homophobia that they saw around them, or in the classism that they saw when they recognized that some of their peers couldn't afford to go to college. So there was also the interconnectedness of issues that was very important to them. And that is nothing really new in feminism. Women experience inequalities in so many different ways that feminism is inherently going to be really divergent by context and person. But that was really important to the students. And then the other part is that they changed feminism a lot in the sense that they did a lot of their organizing online and on social media. They were pushing the boundaries of some things. They were very interested in the inclusion of transgender people in the feminist movement. So overall, they continued many of the traditions of feminism, but I think reshaped some of them as well.
Were the young women that you talked to aware of what had come before them in terms of the feminist movement? Or for them, were they experiencing it, these issues personally, and that this is the now and we need to make change now, as opposed to thinking about where they were on the continuum of the feminist movement?
I was really surprised at what I found when I talked to young people about that in particular, because there was a lot of appreciation for what feminists of previous generations had gone through and what their victories. They knew that there have been many changes, dramatic changes in the past 30 years specifically, and they talked about them and were appreciative of them in many ways. So I didn't find a negativity at all. I found more of an appreciation, but also a sense of moving forward.
Did you talk to women and men?
It's interesting you ask that, because I started the study and I wanted to talk to both women and men, because I thought that, you know, if there was a man who was a feminist who wanted to talk to me, I'd love that. And we talk a lot about how men should be included in the feminist movement and are in many ways. But men weren't very interested in participating in my research as much as I thought they might be. So really, although there were some men in the feminist organizations I did research with, I interviewed some men, it was really women who wanted to talk to me about feminism.
Do you have the sense that if we as a society were to achieve this nirvana of gender equality, that we would see violence against women drop?
Yes, absolutely.
It seems to make sense to me. Mm-hmm. But then I stop and think, but we still have violence. Men are still violent to men. Mm-hmm. Women, maybe on less occasion, are still violent to women.
Yeah.
So where do you see those two things intersecting? Equality and violence.
Well, I think that the power hierarchies and the whose lives we value more than others, I mean, we can see that how it goes through the justice system, whose voices we listen to, whose experiences we value, what episodes draw national attention and what episodes don't. I mean, I think there's a really important connection there, and I don't think it would be a complete utopia, but I think many of the forms of gender inequality that we observe devolve into violence, and then after that, a lack of recognition of how it is then related to the gender power hierarchy. So kind of a circle there.
Let's talk about Roger Ailes for a moment. He was let go from Fox over sexual assault claims. He was paid all this severance. Basically, he's getting away with what he did over the last two decades. We don't ever get to hear any specifics, but clearly it's bad enough that he's being paid millions of dollars to go away. What kind of message do you think this sends to the men and women in our country when something like this is allowed to happen?
Well, it says that certain men can get away with anything. It says that if you're in a certain position of power or domination, you can get away with a lot and you can abuse your power and certainly not feel the ramifications of it that I believe somebody should. I think it means that women's voices and experiences are not valued. It's another example of how in the dialogue around the Ailes controversy, it was asked more often, why did you stay, to those women, rather than why should they be working in such a hostile work environment? More often than not, it feels like women are blamed for those sorts of situations rather than the man who's perpetrating it. So I think it's really a reflection of a lot of what we already know about gender inequality and sexism, and kind of a reminder of the ways in which it's perpetuated and the ways in which it's still here. I think it also is an opportunity to invite more men to stand up, to say, no, this isn't right, to stand up either against him if they're in the same company, or to stand up in solidarity with women who experience sexual harassment all around the world.
In spite of the ongoing feminist movement, mm-hmm. there are still plenty of people who would consider themselves against it.
Yes.
Knowing that that's out there, and knowing that it's often accompanied by violence or, you know, internet trolls or any manner of things that could scare somebody who is vocal about being a feminist and is mm-hmm. taking action around feminist issues. With all of that out there, What is your comfort level mm-hmm. about being an outspoken mm-hmm. feminist and speaking about the feminist movement?
Mm-hmm. I think it's just really important that in order to push against the status quo or create change, that's what you have to do, and you have to deal with the consequences. And I think it's important that that I am careful about making myself feel safe or protected or in the company of people that I love. But I think at the same time, it's got to be going out of your comfort zone a little bit, because feminism has always been about pushing that, and it's not going to come easy, and it never has. And feminists of all generations have always confronted negativity when they speak out. Just how it goes when you try to make change. So I think it's expected.
When you went to talk to the women at the three campuses that you went to, which, by the way, we should say what they were.
Yes, they were UC Santa Barbara, the University of Minnesota, and Smith College.
So two of those three you went to.
Correct. Yes.
Why was that coincidence? Or what?
No, it wasn't coincidence. So I did have entree, and that was an important part of it. And I talked with my advisors and my peers a lot about this. I could have either chosen three schools that I had nothing to do with just because I had nothing to do with them. But what worked out about these schools is that they were in different parts of the country. They had different demographics, different activist cultures, and just totally different types of schools. And so it made for a really good comparative study.
I mean, what were some of the key findings?
Yeah, what was interesting is that there were some key themes that ran through the campuses, but there were really interesting differences. So, for example, UC Santa Barbara is there's a high population of Latina students, and they were very active and organized, especially in their multicultural sororities. And they talked about how important it was to encourage their younger sisters or Latinas who were in high schools around UC Santa Barbara to come to the university. And that to them was a very important feminist mission to them. UC Santa Barbara is a very activist campus. And so that the feminists there felt very supported. And I saw feminism diffused into a lot of different types of organizations. At the University of Minnesota, there was a very strong feminist community, but it was a result of the fact that there were many adversaries who weren't so much of a fan of the feminist student organizations. So because they had to kind of fight for their resources and they had to stand up and talk about all the ways that feminism and activism was important, it caused them to have a really tight-knit community there. So that was an interesting finding, especially at the University of Minnesota. And at Smith College, they all sort of expected that they were feminists. So there was less of an urgency about the issues because they said, oh, you know, this is a women's school. It has many feminist principles to it. So feminism didn't have such an immediacy, but it was assumed to be all around them. And that was frustrating to some of the activists there because there were still issues that they thought warranted attention from feminists on the campus. But everybody thought, oh, we're all on the same page. So they didn't have as much support as they would like. But they did do some organizing there as well.
So at Minnesota, where not everyone was on the same page, mm-hmm. what does anyone have against feminism? I mean, mm-hmm. if it's defined as equality, mm-hmm. what is the problem?
Yeah, it's a good question.
Let's solve it right here.
the problem there, I think, was that it was those groups were funded by student service fees. And since the feminist organization was specifically a women's organization and all students paid into student service fees, men and women, some people objected to that. And also the feminists in the women's organization had very progressive views about things. They handed out condoms. They talked about sexuality. They cared about reproductive rights. So I think there was a sense that, hey, if I don't agree with that, why should some of my money go to that group? Most people, however, didn't worry so much about where every penny of their student service fees went. But there was a group of vocal people who objected to that.
So I can't have this conversation with someone from Stanford without bringing up the Brock Turner case and the sexual assault that he was convicted of and all of the outrage that came out around the length of his sentence. Where did the Clayman Institute fall into that conversation? I mean, given everything that you study mm-hmm. and stand for.
Mm-hmm. Well, what we're interested in at the Clayman Institute is thinking through the culture of sexual assault more broadly. So before that happened, we had already started an 18-month symposium called Breaking the Culture of Sexual Assault. So we had already been very involved with a number of different people on campus. There are a lot of people on campus who are interested in these issues, but we're looking at thinking about the different parts of society that perpetuate the culture of sexual assault. So we're looking at and thinking about and facilitating dialogues about how masculinity and dominant cultures of masculinity perpetuate sexual assault, or about the importance of the intersectional nature of understanding sexual assault. It's not just about women. It's about women and complex identities, and it's about men. So I think that we're a big part of the way that the campus is thinking through these issues. And I think that that continues. We have men who are interested in talking about these issues on campus. We have some great researchers in our institute and undergraduates as well who are interested in continuing to change the way we talk about sexual assault on campus. So I'm not exactly sure what's going to happen, but I'm feeling that we're at a moment where people are really ready to talk about it and make some changes.
What's the best advice that you've ever been given about how to respond to someone who does not share your feminist point of view?
Stay calm. Stay calm, I think, because oftentimes it's really difficult to have a discussion with somebody when you disagree so fundamentally about the principles of gender and gender inequality. And I think what I've learned along the way is to stay calm, to try to put myself in that person's shoes as much as possible and think if there could be a positive outcome of that conversation. Because I think when things get heated or agitated, nobody really learns from it.
Allison, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
That was Lauren Schiller, host of Inflection Point, produced at KALW in San Francisco, speaking with Dr. Allison Dahl Crossley of the Clayman Institute for Gender Research at Stanford University. Dr. Crossley's new book, Finding Feminism, Millennial Activists and the Unfinished Gender Revolution, will be out this spring. We tend to remember Maya Angelou for her activism in the United States, but a recent tribute at James Madison University in Virginia showed her poetry's global appeal. And as John Last discovered, Angelou's influences were as much African as they were American.
You may write me down in history with your bitter, twisted lies. You may trod me in the very dirt, but still like dust, I'll rise.
This is the Maya Angelou most of us know. A warrior for civil rights, whose words channeled the spirit and resilience of a generation of African Americans. Angelou's African years are often only a footnote to this larger story. But to Bessie Mahanja, a professor of Africana studies at James Madison University, they were some of the most important in her life.
Maya speaks in riddles sometimes, in metaphors, in proverbs, and a lot of...
Mahanja was a panelist at a recent tribute to Angelou's global legacy at JMU's Furious Flower Poetry Center. She's from Kenya, almost 4,000 miles from Angelou's African home. But still, she says, Angelou's poetry holds a special kind of power.
I think for the people in Africa, for the people in Kenya, hearing that kind of language was very much like hearing themselves speak. I grew up hearing my elders speak like that. I grew up speaking like that myself sometimes, and now I speak like that even more when I go back home.
Angelou spent only 5 years in Africa in the early 60s, but those happen to be some of the most exceptional years in the history of the continent. Ghana had just declared its independence from colonial rule, and Angelou's living room was routinely populated by some rather exceptional guests.
You know, we're talking about MLK, Malcolm X, Muhammad Ali, and of course, W.E.B. Du Bois. Ghana, sort of, for Black peoples globally, became a center of freedom, a center of fighting for people of African descent's rights across the world. So what was happening in Ghana was not just about Ghana. It was about all of the African diaspora.
During this time, Mahanja says, Angelou embraced the humanistic philosophy of the Pan-Africanist movement.
Being in a space where you understand the struggle for equality as a global struggle for Black people and for others. To fight for those rights was to fight for the rights of humanity. In every poem you read, if you really stop to pay attention and listen to it, you do hear that same message coming through, that it's all about recognizing each other's humanity.
When Angelou returned to the United States in 1966, she arrived with a new vocabulary, drawn from the optimism of a rising continent and the belief in a common human struggle for dignity. And like Mahandra says, you can hear these words in every poem, like this one called The Human Family.
I note the obvious differences between each sort and type, but we are more alike, my friends, than we are unalike. We are more alike, my friends, than we are unalike.
For the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, I'm John Last.
Now we have a story about a rarely talked about consequence of military service, the thousands of American veterans whose combat injuries have left them infertile. And for the first time, Congress is trying to address the issue. A newly passed law directs the VA to start paying for wounded veterans' fertility treatments, including in vitro fertilization for veterans and their spouses. Patricia Murphy spoke with a family who lobbied for the new law.
When Jeff Lynch left his new bride, Christy, and deployed to Iraq as an infantry soldier in 2005, Christy says neither one of them were thinking about children.
When Jeff and I got married, we were 18. We didn't expect to need IVF to have a family.
Jeff was injured during his first deployment. When he deployed again, a second injury ended his military career.
We were on a convoy and we got hit with a daisy chain. A daisy chain is basically, they put an IED, which is an improvised explosive device, every 10 to 15 meters apart or 200 meters apart.
Lynch has endured more than 100 surgeries. Though the couple has one child, the lingering effects of his injuries and his medications have left him unable to have more children naturally. So the Lynches began exploring in vitro fertilization, but the procedure's $15,000 cost was daunting for the family.
It was something that we could afford and we could make it work, but it was something we weren't comfortable putting all of that money into without having a guaranteed outcome.
IVF is financially out of reach for many wounded vets' families, and since 1992, Congress has banned the VA from paying for it. Democratic Washington Senator Patty Murray has been fighting to lift the ban since 2012, and this fall, she finally succeeded. Now the VA will pay for IVF for wounded veterans injured during their service.
We all say when someone serves our country, we are there for them when they come home. Certainly, allowing them to fulfill their dream of having a family ought to be part of what we are there for them when they return.
Murray says one of the reasons it took so long was resistance from conservative lawmakers.
Individual lawmakers were making a decision having to do with a woman's right to choose, not about making sure that these men and women could fulfill their dream through IVF.
Christy and Jeff Lynch were one of several couples who lobbied lawmakers for the bill. They encountered the same concerns.
One of the questions we were asked was, you know, what do you do with your leftover embryos? You know, the response that we had to that was none of your business what we choose to do with our leftover embryos. You know, those are ours.
The new law came too late to help the Lynches. By the time it passed, they had already undergone IVF through a doctor who treats wounded vets for a reduced fee. And now they're expecting twins.
I built stuff out of wood, so I built that toy box for my daughter.
The Lynch's small three-bedroom house near Raleigh, North Carolina, is already crowded with toys that belong to their seven-year-old daughter, Caitlin. And the tight space is about to get tighter.
I just want her and the two babies come out healthy. That's all I want.
And Christy wants all wounded veterans to have the option of using IVF under their VA benefits. The new law is only temporary. It expires in 2 years, and Christy plans to keep fighting to make it permanent.
Jeff has a friend who is almost like a brother to him, who is a paraplegic, and you know, we didn't want him and his future wife to have to fight this battle.
Congressional supporters estimate that as many as 2,000 wounded vets could potentially pursue IVF through the VA. I'm Patricia Murphy reporting.
And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at WAMC.org. And follow us on Twitter at 51% Radio. This week's show is number 1433.